We're going to hear now about hundreds of artificial birds' nests built by scientists in the Canadian Arctic. They want to know why Arctic shorebirds fly thousands of miles to lay their eggs. Here's NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce.
Consider a bird like the white-rumped sandpiper. It weighs less than 2 ounces, but each year, this little white and brown bird leaves the southern tip of South America and flies more than 9,000 miles to its breeding grounds in the Arctic.
This is one of the reasons why I was interested in these birds, is because of their amazing migration strategies.
Laura McKinnon is a researcher with the University of Quebec at Rimouski.
I've always been interested in, you know, the cost and benefits of flying further north.
Migrating to the Arctic is exhausting and dangerous. But the benefits for shorebirds include lots of daylight, plenty of food for their young, and fewer parasites. McKinnon and her colleagues thought there might be one other advantage, too.
We thought that another one of the benefits of breeding further north could be reduced predation risk, and that's why we looked into this question.
After all, a nest of eggs is a tasty snack, and the Arctic has relatively few predators. This is where the artificial nests come in. McKinnon and her colleagues wanted to watch nests at different breeding sites to see how long a nest could last without being plundered by an Arctic fox or predatory bird. But they knew that some shorebirds are better than others at hiding their nests or fending off attackers. To make sure everything was equal at all of their study sites, McKinnon and her team decided to create fake nests full of tempting eggs.
Luckily, shorebird nests are very, very simple, and they are essentially just a small depression in the ground.
So the nest part was easy, even though they had to build more than 1,500 of them. Filling all those nests was a lot harder. The researchers used real quail eggs, which are similar in size and color to many Arctic shorebirds' eggs.
We have to take those in our hand luggage on the plane going up to the Arctic. It's a little bit of a challenge to get them there in one piece.
They took these eggs to 7 remote breeding sites. The sites spanned 2,000 miles from the subarctic to the high Arctic. What the scientists learned is published in the journal Science. McKinnon says the further north a shorebird's nest is, the less likely its eggs are to become someone's dinner.
So a bird flying to Akamiski, which is the most southern part, if it decides to fly another 3,350 kilometers to alert Ellesmere Island, it can reduce its predation risk by 66%.
This means the scientists' initial hunch about the role of predators appears to be right. David Lank studies shorebirds at Simon Fraser University near Vancouver.
You know, they've taken us a step closer towards understanding why birds might go so far.
But he says the study also raises some questions.
If it were so great to always go as far as possible so that you'd have the highest probability of your nest hatching, why doesn't everyone do it?
Some birds stop at the lower Arctic, so maybe they prefer features like its longer nesting season. Still, he says, all of this just goes to show. A long trip that seems crazy to us can make sense for a bird that just wants to raise a family. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Britain's shivering through its coldest winter weather in 30 years. The Chinese capital of Beijing had its biggest one-day snowfall since 1951. And much of the U.S. is thawing out from an almost month-long freeze. But in one unexpected place, it's downright balmy, at least relatively speaking, and that place is the North Pole. It turns out parts of the Arctic are 10 to 15 degrees warmer than they should be at this time of year. So what's behind the unusual weather?
Well, I think it's all about the Arctic Oscillation.
That's Mark Serez. He's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and he joins me from Boulder. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I understand that center is where the frozen are chosen?
That's right, the National Snow and Ice Data Center, where the frozen are chosen.
Where the frozen are chosen. Okay. So now that we've uncovered the culprit behind all this extra cold weather, explain what exactly Arctic oscillation is.
All right. Well, if we look at the weather patterns over the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, sometimes we find that the surface pressure, the amount of atmospheric pressure we have, is a little lower in the Arctic than it is in the middle latitudes. And then sometimes it shifts So the Arctic gets a little more and the mid-latitudes get a little less. Well, that shift in atmospheric mass or pressure is really how we define the Arctic Oscillation. But the interesting thing is that these shifts in pressure are associated with changes in weather that really reverberate throughout the Northern Hemisphere.
I'm sure, as you've seen, there have been some sort of climate change, let's call them skeptics, sort of suggesting that this disproves climate change. Does it have anything to do with it?
Well, what we're seeing here has nothing to do with global warming. What we're seeing is crazy weather. At the very same time that we've seen these areas in the middle latitudes with sub-zero temperatures and big snowstorms, the Arctic has been much, much warmer than normal.
Now, in December, the Arctic Oscillation went into what's called an extreme negative phase. Is that rare?
Well, what we've seen this December was certainly exceedingly rare. It would be like if you had a deck of cards and you told someone, well, I'm going to pull the ace of spades out of here, and you actually did it, right? Well, having us going into this extreme negative mode is even more rare than something like that.
Now, if the Arctic was much warmer over the past few weeks, does that affect the sea ice? I mean, presumably it means that the sea ice will melt more quickly.
On the one hand, with this extreme phase of the Arctic Oscillation, the Arctic has been very, very warm. That means less ice grows in the winter. On the other hand, the changing pattern of winds means that less ice in the Arctic gets transported out of the Arctic into the North Atlantic where it would melt. So the Arctic kind of holds on to the ice that it has. Mm. So you have these competing effects. And who's going to win? We'll probably have the answers of that, say, sometime in April. We don't know right now.
I mean, do you have a sense of what this might mean for the Arctic and the summer ice melt?
I think it's going to have an overall negative effect. If you look at the extent of Arctic sea ice and compare it with normal, we're already about 1 million square kilometers in the hole.
Wow. Okay?
In other words, 1 million square kilometers below average. So it's not like the ice is really recovering from this. But we'll see what happens in the spring. The real fascination with climate science is there's a lot that we do understand, but there's a lot that we still don't.
That's Mark Serez. He's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Mark Serez, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And as Mark Serez just said, this winter's Arctic warming isn't related to long-term climate change. But to science writer Alan Anderson, the big-picture trend is clear. The Arctic sea ice will eventually disappear. And he's written a book about it. It's called After the Ice. And Alan Anderson joins me from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You say that climate change is more acute in the Arctic than anywhere else, that it's sort of the canary in the coal mine. Give us an example of what you mean.
Well, that's exactly right. And we know that by the fact that the ice there is disappearing so rapidly. You know, every summer now, the ice is vanishing from the Arctic at a speed we would never have even thought of a couple of decades ago.
You describe something in your book which you call the Arctic revenge, something that
yes.
will affect us living below the Arctic, I presume, at some point.
Once the tundra that rims the Arctic starts to thaw, what we'll see is greenhouse gases pouring out of that tundra. Already in the warmer points around the Arctic, you'll see very odd bubblings in a lake. What you can do, if you're fairly adventurous, is reach out over that little pond and light a match above that bubbling and just get a poof of flame. That is methane bubbling out of lakes as they thaw and microorganisms start to be able to digest basically the humus, the rotten material at the bottom of the lake. Elsewhere, frozen ground is bubbling out carbon dioxide. These are powerful greenhouse gases. As time goes by, the more it thaws, the more will pour out, the more the earth will warm. That's number one. But there are a couple of other things it's got in mind for you too.
A couple of other things?
There's the well-known one, of course, of sea level rise. Sitting on top of Greenland is a vast ice cap. As that melts away, it pours back into the sea and raises sea levels worldwide. If the whole thing melts, sea level rise will be about 23 feet around the world.
That's not going to happen overnight, right? I mean, this isn't something that's going to happen in our lifetime.
No, it would take hundreds, probably thousands of years for all the ice to melt. But once it really gets going, it will become unstoppable.
And the consequences beyond rising sea levels are changes in the weather, for example?
Yes. The wider changes will be changes in the weather and so on. But, you know, for the people of the Arctic and the animals that live in the Arctic, I think we've run out of time because the ice they depend on is going. The ice that sits on top of Greenland, not the sea ice, is a little bit different. We've had more chance to save that, quite definitely. But the ice that fills that ocean is going, and I don't think now that we're able to stop it.
How long will it take, based on your estimate, before we reach a point where there is no longer any ice in the Arctic in the summertime?
The very earliest estimates are 2013. Other estimates are 2050, but a broad consensus among scientists seems to be 2030 now.
Alan Anderson, what will the Arctic look like in the summertime by the middle of this century?
Well, it'll be a mostly open sea. And for me, I guess the biggest shock is, you know, I always think of the polar bears when I think of the Arctic. It just comes automatically. The polar bear is the king of the Arctic, the top predator. It'll be gone. And in its place, we will see killer whales. The killer whale will be the new top predator of the Arctic. A killer whale living in open water will be the symbol of the Arctic, you know, replacing a bear on ice. That's an astonishing change.
Describe for me some of the people that you encountered living above the Arctic Circle. About half of the people who live in the Arctic Circle are members of an indigenous tribe, and the other half, primarily in Russia, as you describe, are people who sort of settled in the area.
Yeah. Well, my very first visit to the Arctic was when I landed at a place called Grisfjord in the very, very northern part of Canada. And there I was really shocked because walking along the beach, I saw seals that had been hunted, other seals that had been cut up. There was the head of a narwhal with its pointed lance, the one that inspired the myth of the unicorn, sitting there. This was a real hunting community. And for me, used to shopping in a supermarket, I was just stunned. But a few months later, when I understood how the Arctic work, I did go out hunting seal with some Inuit people and got to have a feel of how they felt and how they lived.
And in your book, you make the argument that it's not hunting of seals or of the narwhal or the polar bears that is threatening the Arctic, but it is human behavior in most of the rest of the world that is destroying the Arctic.
Yes, of course, it's the warming that we are generating by filling the air with greenhouse gases that's really hammering the Arctic now. And I have to say it's the third time for them up there. The first wave of southerners were whalers who slaughtered huge numbers of whales and made it very difficult for them to live there. The second wave was air pollution going up south and poisoning the ice, and now we're doing it again with global warming. So they've had it pretty tough from us southerners.
I want to ask you about the politics of the Arctic, because as you write, there are actually serious national security implications for the ice melt, for what's going on in the Arctic, particularly with respect, for example, to U.S.-Russia relations. There are disputes over who owns what the closer you get to the North Pole, right?
Absolutely. You can't claim the actual water, the fish, or any sort of territorial right, but you can get everything that's on the sea bottom, which means oil, gas, possibly minerals. So that's what everybody's after, the rights to those. I think a very serious problem is developing. As the ice is turning to water, the area becomes much more accessible. As it becomes accessible, you need to be able to police and patrol it. And nobody has the capacity to police and patrol it at the moment.
What needs to happen from a policy perspective, in your view, right now, to preserve the Arctic?
Two big things. The first is, don't put any more stresses on the Arctic. So strict regulation on drilling for oil, any ships trying to go through the Arctic, you know, good search and rescue. If there ever were an oil spill, let's make sure we could deal with it quickly. So let's not do anything else that's going to mess up the Arctic. Control that. At the moment, we don't have the rules, the regulations, and we don't have the ships, the planes to look after the place. And the second thing is, of course, to try to tackle global warming and cut back on our greenhouse gas emissions. And the faster we can do that, the better.
That's Alan Anderson. He is the former editor-in-chief of New Scientist magazine and the author of the book After the Ice, Life, Death, and Geopolitics in the New Arctic. Alan Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
When hackers released some emails a couple of months ago of some of the world's leading experts on global warming, it caused them huge embarrassment. The messages revealed ugly sniping going on behind the public discourse. Climate change skeptics have pointed to those emails as evidence that global warming is a hoax. And even believers say the emails raise questions about scientific conduct. NPR's John Hamilton wanted to see just how hot things have gotten in the world of climate science, so he spent some time in Atlanta with researchers at the annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society.
The most notorious email seemed to discuss ways to prevent publication of research that challenged global warming. One also used the unfortunate word trick to describe a technique to massage temperature data. That sort of stuff has certainly made things more difficult for public figures trying to get limits on carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases. But researchers in the trenches of climate science say there's really been no effect on the consensus that the Earth really is warming up. The trenches at the Meteorological Society meeting can be found in a vast underground chamber at the Georgia World Congress Center. It's filled with seemingly endless aisles of so-called poster presentations and their authors. Kevin Gobert of Valparaiso University in Indiana is standing in front of his poster describing trends in Australian cyclones.
Ultimately, I don't think there was anything within the emails that really, you know, caused a great debate within the scientific community about the validity of the climate science.
Not far away, Dave Gutzler from the University of New Mexico has a poster about 20th century droughts in the U.S. Gutzler says he and his colleagues tend to focus on climate data, not commentary, and he says the data haven't changed.
There are multiple lines of evidence that involve both completely independent data sets, such as glacier retreat, plus a whole body of modeling, plus a lot of process-based research about measuring heat in the oceans and things like that, that all point in the same direction.
But Gutzler says the emails have shown something most researchers already knew about climate science, but the public may not have.
It's contentious. It's sometimes nasty. That's because we're people. And we're dealing with problems that people care about very intensely, both for personal and professional reasons and because the public cares about it.
Marcus Williams is a graduate student at Florida State University whose poster describes temperature variability in the southeastern U.S. Williams says the nastiness of the emails has hurt the field, even if it hasn't undermined the science.
It did take a hit on our credibility somewhat. I mean, it's never good to have people kind of pushing false agendas out there.
The emails weren't part of the meeting's formal program, but they did come up frequently in sessions about climate. And one question scientists had was how to restore their damaged credibility. Chris Folland from the UK's Meteorological Office says one way would be to let everybody see the data that scientists have been using.
It would be very good to make all the data sets available that contribute to that land surface temperature data set and, of course, the sea surface temperature data sets. And indeed, all the other major data sets that are used in climate science.
Fallon concedes that could be tricky, though, because much of the data is proprietary. Other researchers suggested a new focus on the ethical issues involved in publishing climate studies. They say the emails show that the peer review process can allow personal views rather than objective evaluation to affect where a paper gets published. Bill Hook is in charge of policy for the American Meteorological Society. He says climate researchers need to realize that they are now in a very bright spotlight and act accordingly.
This science has gone from science that's a sideshow in human affairs to science that matters, to science where people are placing billion-dollar and even trillion-dollar bets. And that requires a certain level of professionalism and caution about all communication.
Hook says the email incident has offered climate scientists a pointed reminder of just how much is at stake and how easily things can go awry. John Hamilton, NPR News.